Following decisive victories at Winchester and Fisher's Hill in September 1864, General Philip Sheridan believed his Union Army finally had gained control of Virginia's Shenandoah Valley. Sheridan's opponent, Confederate General Jubal Early, had other ideas. Less than a month after suffering those apparently fatal defeats, he saw an opportunity to catch the overconfident Union Army by surprise. After Sheridan's systematic destruction of the valley's resources, an episode known ever since as the Burning, Early crept back north, finding Sheridan's Union Army camped along Cedar Creek near Strasburg. On a foggy morning, October 19th, the Confederates struck hard, swarming into sleepy Union camps. Driven north by Early's relentless advance, Federal officers struggled for control, finally establishing a battle line near Middletown, miles away from the Union positions that morning. What happened next was one of the most dramatic battle reversals of the Civil War. Learn that story and follow the action that day in this 10-stop driving tour of the Battle of Cedar Creek. Your narrator is Eric Campbell, Chief of Interpretation for the Cedar Creek and Belgrove National Historical Park. It's especially important to download the tour map and printed driving directions, since no turn-by-turn directions are given in the narrative and no directional signs mark the tour route. Find the map and directions on CivilWarTraveler.com/audio. The tour begins at the Cedar Creek Battlefield Foundation Visitor Center across Route 11 from Belgrove, south of Middletown. Be sure to pause your device after each stop and resume the narration at the next one. Now let's join Eric for your tour of Cedar Creek. I'm John Fiesel. Have a great tour.
Welcome to this podcast tour of the Cedar Creek Battlefield. You should be standing in front of the Cedar Creek Battlefield Headquarters building, which is located along the Valley Pike, modern Route 11. Turn and face to the west, or towards the mountain range you see in the distance. This is the Allegheny Mountain Range, which forms the western edge of the Shenandoah Valley. The eastern edge is formed by the Blue Ridge Mountain Range to your rear. And if you look to your left rear, through the trees and above the red-roofed barn, you'll notice the rising northern end of the Massanutten Mountain Range, which we will discuss in more detail and how it relates to the battle at Stop 2. On October 18, 1864, the 30,000-man Union Army of the Shenandoah was camped in the fields before you. Its nerve center, the headquarters of the Army of the Shenandoah, was located at Belgrove, the plantation manor house you see in your immediate foreground amongst the trees. The Union Army was composed of three Army Corps and was commanded by Major General Philip Sheridan. In mid-October, this army was camped on the bluffs above Cedar Creek to your front and left front. The 6th Corps, the largest Army Corps, was located in the high ground and fields directly west or beyond Belgrove. The 19th Corps was camped on bluffs above Cedar Creek to your left front, today marked by the thick tree line you see across the fields to your left front. The 8th Army Corps, also known as the Army of West Virginia, was camped on this side, or on the east side of the Valley Pike, about 1.5 to 2 miles to your left and left rear. Following a series of brilliant victories fought in September and October of 1864, Sheridan and his men believed the campaign was over and the Confederate Army was fully defeated. Sheridan himself was so confident in this fact that he felt comfortable in leaving the Army on October 15th in order to travel to Washington, D.C., when he was called away for a council of war. He would not return to this area until the afternoon of October 18th, arriving at Winchester, 15 miles north of Cedar Creek. Little did Sheridan and his men realize, however, the Confederate Army was not defeated, as they'd find out much to their surprise on the morning of October 19th, when the Confederates were able to launch a surprise attack against them, the beginning phases of the Battle of Cedar Creek. We will discuss that surprise attack, where it was launched, and why it was launched, at our next stop, Stop 2. At this point, proceed to stop number 2 by following your map to Bowman's Mill Road. You'll be parking along the road near a metal gate where the road turns sharply left and begins to descend downhill. This gate is clearly marked no trespassing and also by a small white sign that says Shenandoah Valley Battlefields Foundation. You're now located at stop number 2. The best place to listen to this stop would be on the opposite side of the road, under the trees. You should be facing, then, the Massanutten Mountain Range, which you clearly see looming before you. At that point, you'll be facing to the south-southwest. This location is near the left end of the Union Army, held by the 8th Corps, otherwise known as the Army of West Virginia. These men were camped on the highest ground above Cedar Creek. The creek would be located at the lowest ground below you, running essentially from your right and right front across your front to the left front, at which point it then eventually flows into the North Fork of the Shenandoah River at the base of the Massanutten Mountain Range. The northern end of the Massanutten Mountain Range is actually marked by Three Top Mountain, otherwise known as the Three Sisters, and the largest of these, the most important in relationship to the battle, is called Signal Knob, which actually has a signal tower located on its peak. During the Civil War, both armies used that highest peak as a signal station to instantly send messages via signal flag from its summit. 2 days before the battle, on October 17th, Confederate officers, including Major General John Brown Gordon, climbed to the top of Signal Knob. Gordon had a beautiful bird's-eye view looking straight down on the Union forces and its position, and reported what he found back to his commander, Lieutenant General Juba Early. Early commanded the Confederate forces in the valley, otherwise known as the Army of the Valley. Despite his previous defeats, General Early still believed he could regain the Confederate fortunes in the valley by making one more attack. He faces many difficulties. Not only is the Union Army located here in a seemingly impregnable position, but even worse, Early's forces are outnumbered almost 2-1. The Confederate forces on the eve of the battle number between 14,000 and 15,000 men. Gordon's report, however, from Signal Knob gives Early renewed hope. Apparently, the left end of the Union line, which would also now be to your left, was unprotected. If somehow Early could get the largest part of the Confederate army opposite the Union left, he felt he could launch a surprise dawn attack and roll up the Union army from your left to right, or from east to west. In order to put the attack force beyond the left end of the Union line, which again is located slightly to your left, it would require the Confederates to make a 10-mile march, including complicated night crossings of the North Fork of the Shenandoah River, and traversing a very narrow path, requiring them to march single file at times along the base of the Massanutten Mountain Range before you. Furthermore, the attack would have to be launched by surprise. Despite the risk, this is a very audacious and risky plan, Early ordered the movement to be executed on the night of October 18th. This required an all-night march starting somewhere around 8 to 9 o'clock at night. The Confederate Army at this point is located about 5 miles to your south of Strasburg, which is directly to your front, and the march continued successfully until the Confederates reached their attack positions around 4:30 in the morning, at which point, completely undetected, they're ready to launch their attack. The attack will come from two directions. Three divisions of the Confederate Army, or approximately 8,000 men, will be located a mile to your left, or to your east. Another division, just under 3,000 men, will come directly from your front, or south. Further assisting the Confederate Army in launching this surprise attack was a thick layer of fog which formed on the morning of October 19th, covering the area before you. At 4:30, having successfully completed this risky maneuver, the Confederate attack began, and the attack was launched with complete surprise, overrunning the Union outposts at Cedar Creek and the low ground before you, and driving them back to the main Union line here. By the time the Confederate force struck this line, the 8th Corps was caught completely by surprise. Many of the Union soldiers were still in their tents. Most of the Union force had little time to even form a battle line, yet alone reply to the Confederate onslaught, which quickly overran the Union breastworks and entrenchments in this area. Many Union forces in the 8th Corps were shot in their tents or bayoneted before they had a chance to react. The Confederates swarmed over the entrenchments, overran Union artillery pieces here, and began to drive the 8th Corps back to your right rear or to your northwest as the Confederate attack swept through this area. One Confederate soldier, after sweeping over the ground you're standing on, looked to his front, which would be to your right rear, and described the chaos of the Union army retreating before him. "Such a sight as met our eyes," he said, "as we mounted their earthworks was not often seen. For a mile or more in every direction towards the rear was a vast plain or broken plateau, with not a tree or a shrub in sight. Tents whitened the field from one end to the other, while the country behind was one living sea of Union men and horses, all fleeing for life and safety. Men, shoeless and hatless, went flying like mad to the rear, some with and some without guns. Caissons were going like the wind, the drivers laying the lash all the while. Such confusion, such a panic was never witnessed before by our troops." What we will do at this point is essentially follow the flow of battle from south to north, or from here to your rear or behind you, as the Confederate attack is going to overrun each Union position it encounters along the way. The next two stops, however, will take us downhill to the locations where the Confederate forces actually crossed Cedar Creek and the Shenandoah River in preparation to launch the surprise attack we just described. We will now proceed to stop number three, which is located along Cedar Creek at Bowman's Mill Ford. Proceed downhill, and when you reach the creek, you will stop just short of the low water bridge. Pull off to the right side of the road as much as possible to let other vehicles pass by. You're now located at Bowman's Mill Ford. The Confederates, who attacked the Union position on the morning of October 19th, crossed this creek and the North Fork of the Shenandoah River at three fords. A division, led by Major General Joseph Beecher Shaw, just under 3,000 men, crossed here at this ford, at which point they used the road we just drove down to attack the Union 8th Corps, which we discussed at stop number two. It's not hard to imagine from this remote location, in the pre-dawn hours of October 19th, thousands of Confederate soldiers splashing across this stream in preparation to make their attack. Recall again, completing their surprise was a dense fog that had settled down in this low ground, hiding their presence until they were almost on top of the Union line. We will now proceed to stop four, which is Long Meadow, located along Long Meadow Road. Park near the end of the driveway to Long Meadow, along the right side of the road without blocking traffic. You're now located at Long Meadow, which is the site of one of the earliest settlement homes in this area. Isaac Height settled this area and built a large log structure in the 1730s along the banks of the North Fork of the Shenandoah River. That log structure was replaced by the current brick structure you see today in the 1840s. During the Battle of Cedar Creek, the largest part of the Confederate attack force actually crossed the Shenandoah River behind you, marched up the farm lane past Long Meadow, and then continued up the road in front of you that we are soon going to drive in order to reach their attack positions, which we described as stop number two. Leading one division of this attack force was a 27-year-old Major General, Stephen Dodson Ramser, the youngest Major General in the Confederate Army. This up-and-coming star had just recently been married, less than a year before, and had just found out a few days before the battle that his first child had been born. Ramser was not sure yet whether he had a son or a daughter, but was hoping to win a great victory here at Cedar Creek so he could return home on a furlough and visit his wife and new child. We will come back to Ramser and his story later in the tour. As you travel up the road, keep in mind you are following the route of the Confederate march as it moved into its attack positions that morning. When you turn left onto Water Plant Road, you will be actually turning and moving in the same direction the Confederates would have as they launched their attack that dawn against the left and rear of the 8th Corps that we described at stop number two. Stop 5 is located at the 128th New York Monument on the west side of the Valley Pike. As you approach the 128th New York Monument, please be very careful of oncoming traffic on the busy Valley Pike. Pull up the gravel embankment and park in front of the monument. You're now located at stop number 5. Facing the monument before you, you're looking at the 128th New York Memorial, dedicated 43 years after the battle by the surviving veterans of the regiment itself. This monument marks the position of not only the New York Regiment itself, but also the far left end of the 19th Corps' battle line. The 19th Corps would be the next corps in position to face the Confederate onslaught that we just discussed at stops 2, 3, and 4. Turn to your left now, and you'll be facing south, looking along the Valley Pike. Looking to your left front, beyond the trees in your immediate foreground and looming clearly in the distance, is the northern end of the Massanutten Mountain Range, including Signal Knob. In that same direction, but much closer, about a mile away, on that high ground, heavily wooded today, would be one of two 8th Corps camps, including the one marking the far left end of the Union line located where we were at stop two. Immediately to your left, or to your east, you'll see another wooded ridge, traversed today by modern Interstate 81. This ridge marks the second 8th Corps camp, which was commanded by Colonel Rutherford B. Hayes, future President of the United States. As we discussed at stops 2, 3, and 4, the initial Confederate onslaught overran these 8th Corps camps, driving them in confusion in this direction. This attack signaled to the rest of the Union Army, including the 19th Corps located here, that a major Confederate offensive was underway. One member of the 19th Corps later vividly described the Confederate attack to their left. "I was awakened," he said, "at the first signs of day by a terrific clap of thunder and sprang into a sitting position and listened. The thunder was a tremendous volley that the enemy was pouring into the 8th Corps' camp. I listened for the yell of our men, but alas, it never came. Instead, I heard the familiar hi-yi-yi of the rebel yell. And horrors of horrors, it seemed to me as if our whole left end was enveloped, enfolded by this battle cry." Now aware that they were facing a major threat to their left, the 19th Corps reacted and began to shift units to the left or to the east, eventually forming them along the Valley Pike to your left and to your left rear, northward along the pike. Thus, the 19th Corps line was refused close to where we're standing right now. Part of it faced south down the pike, as you're facing, and the remainder faced east along the pike. This movement was completed just as the 8th Corps' shattered lines came retreating down the hillside to your left, across the pike, and through the newly formed lines of the 19th Corps. Despite their ability to prepare for this onslaught, parts of the 19th Corps line were caught by surprise because of the dense fog, hiding the Confederates until they were almost right on top of the Union battle lines. If this situation was not deteriorating quickly enough, the 19th Corps also faced a threat from their front. The third and final phase of the Confederate attack was now moving forward, coming north on the Valley Pike and hitting the Union Army from the front. Thus, the 19th Corps was facing attacks from two directions. Despite the holding actions of the 19th Corps, the overwhelming Confederate numbers, along with the surprise attacks they were able to launch because of the dense fog, will force the 19th Corps to retreat to the northwest or to your right rear, falling back along their entrenchment line in that direction. Thus, the 2nd Union Corps in the Union defense is being toppled by this overwhelmingly successful surprise Confederate attack launched that morning. The remains of the 19th Corps entrenchment line is still visible today on land preserved by the Cedar Creek Battlefield Foundation, and we welcome you to visit that by traveling down the gravel road behind you, which leads to a gate, at which point you can cross through the gate, and you'll pick up a red blazed trail, a mile-long trail, that takes you along those entrenchments line. Once you're completed with this stop, you're welcome to proceed on to stop number 6 by moving northward up the Valley Pike. As you do so, you are following, again, the flow of battle as the Confederates drive the 19th Corps back upon itself in the same direction. The next resistance offered by the 19th Corps will take place at Belgrove Plantation Manor, which is stop number 6. When you park in their parking lot, best place to listen to stop 6 is in the front, on the front lawn of Belgrove. You should now be standing on the front lawn of Belgrove. Looking south, you will clearly see the northern end of the Massanutten Mountain Range, including Signal Knob. Belgrove Plantation Manor House, located behind you, was built in the late 1790s by Isaac Height Jr., who is the son of Isaac Height, the builder of Long Meadow, which we discussed at stop number 4. Isaac Height married Nellie Madison, who was James Madison's sister. Height started with a 480-acre tract of land, and he turned it into a 7,000-acre plantation. The beautiful manor house is now today one of the most recognizable features in the northern end of the Shenandoah Valley. It is currently owned by the National Trust for Historic Preservation and managed by Belgrove Incorporated. This beautifully restored home is now furnished with period belongings, original belongings, and is well worth a visit. Tickets for a tour can be purchased at the entrance below the main steps and is well worth the time. This location also served as the nerve center for the Union Army here at Cedar Creek, being the headquarters of the Army, and the fields around you at the time of the battle were filled with thousands of wagons, supply wagons, ammunition wagons, medical stores, and so forth. Keep in mind, General Sheridan has not yet returned to his army, which on the morning of October 19th was commanded in his place by Major General Horatio Wright. As the continued Confederate assault steamrolled the 8th Corps and now the 19th Corps, those troops began to retreat in this direction, back towards Belgrove, which at that time was now scrambling to try to remove all these wagons, horses, and supplies before the inevitable Confederate assault reached this area. So there was confusion as men retreated through this area. Also, the 19th Corps began to rally their battle lines, trying to delay the Confederate assault in the fields before you, trying to put up stiff resistance, but each successive line was collapsing one after the other. And once again, enabling the Confederates to overwhelm the Union defenders was the dense fog, which masked their movements until they were right on top of the Union line. One 19th Corps soldier later vividly described this. He said, "The fog was so dense that we could not see the enemy in front of us, but the rapid and incessant discharge of small arms and cannon and bursting of shells and the whizzing of bullets mingling into the sound like that of a moaning wind told us unmistakably of his oncoming presence." While the Confederate troops were slowed at this point, eventually, by 7:30 to 8 o'clock, the Union resistance in this area had been overwhelmed. Confederates swarmed across and through the plantation grounds, and now the Union battle line continued to retreat northward and northwestward behind you and to your right rear. Thus, two of the three Union corps making up the Army of the Shenandoah had been driven from their original positions, leaving only one corps, the 6th Corps, to offer any type of firm resistance to the oncoming Confederate attack. The 6th Corps was originally located on high ground to the west of Belle Grove, or to your right. The resistance put up by the other two Union Corps gave the 6th Corps time to ready themselves for the oncoming attack, at which point they began to form battle lines along a stream called Meadowbrook, located to your west or to your right, and begin to prepare themselves for battle. Fighting then would continue to roll across this ground to your right and right rear as the Confederates now brought the 6th Corps under assault. We will now proceed to stop number 7. As you drive along the roads to the next stop, including Meadow Mills Road, keep in mind the 6th Corps was fighting on the high ground on both sides of the road. Though the resistance was stiff, eventually even they, the 6th Corps, were continued to be driven back. Further adding to the confusion were the rest of the Union troops retreating through their lines. Finally, driven north, the 6th Corps managed to rally itself on a hill just west of Middletown, on top of which was the town cemetery. Here, the Union Army would offer its first sustained resistance to the Confederate assault that morning. This would be stop number 7, the Middletown Cemetery. When you park at the cemetery, use the gravel spaces near the front gate, and then proceed inside the cemetery to a white cinder block building where you can listen to stop number 7. You're now located at stop number 7, which is the Mount Carmel Cemetery. At the time of the battle, this was known as the Middletown Cemetery. Best vantage point to hear this stop is near the white cinder block building located near the highest grounds on the hill. Keep in mind, in 1864, the landscape around you was much more open, as the woods to your left, front, and right front did not exist. If you face to the southeast, you'll be looking at our now familiar landscape feature, the northern end of the Massanutten Mountain Range, including Signal Knob. Looking in that same direction, you could see the open fields over which the main Confederate attack was now moving, driving before it the 8th Corps, the 19th Corps, and as we just discussed at stop number 6, the 6th Corps. The 6th Corps, though driven back, was able to offer very stiff resistance. Eventually, one division of the 6th Corps, commanded by Brigadier General George Washington Getty, placed himself upon this hill. From about 8 o'clock in the morning until 9:30, the 6th Corps, formed along this hill and facing both to the southeast or to your front and also to your right or to your south, and with the rest of the 6th Corps line wrapping along the hill in the area where you just drove as you approached the cemetery, would stand against overwhelming Confederate attacks and offer the first solid Union resistance that day. The Confederate force by this point, after advancing over 5 miles, found their battle lines becoming somewhat disorganized and disjointed, and thus the attacks launched against this hill and Getty's division also were launched in a disjointed fashion. The first two attacks were thus repulsed, and at one point General Early, hoping to drive the 6th Corps off this hill and continue the forward advance, ordered 30 cannon, to be formed along the Valley Pike to bombard the very spot where you're standing. Looking again to the southeast or to your front, you'll clearly see the Valley Pike, modern Route 11 today, marked by the tree line below Massanutten Mountain Range and also some modern factory buildings you see to their left along with two towers. It is in that area the Confederate artillery would be formed, bringing the Union soldiers on this hill under intense bombardment. Finally, a third Confederate attack was launched against the hill. The Confederates would first have to splash across Meadow Brook, the stream located along the base of the hill to your left front in front, and then drive up to the very crest of the hill where you're standing, at which point hand-to-hand fighting broke out, including a fierce struggle for a Union artillery battery located in this area. One Union member of the battery later recalled this fight, simply saying it was now man-to-man, hand-to-hand with bayonets and musket butt on their side and revolvers, rammerheads, and handspikes on ours. This attack was also repulsed. However, by this point, the Confederate numbers were overwhelming and outflanking the Union battle line, getting beyond its flanks or ends. And by 9:30, the 6th Corps once again had to retreat to your north or to your left rear, eventually beginning to rally themselves north of Middletown. Middletown is located less than a mile off to your left front or to your east. Another problem faced by the Confederate soldiers by this time, after an all-night march and now having fought a battle for over 5 hours, was not just sheer exhaustion, but also the Union camps through which they had just moved. Keep in mind, by this point, the Confederate Army in the valley was ill-equipped, poorly fed, and in many cases, hundreds of Confederate soldiers, if not thousands, were barefoot. The temptations found by these Confederates in the Union camps they just overrun was simply too much to resist. And one Confederate later described exactly why many Confederates, hundreds, fell out of ranks to plunder the Union camps. He later wrote, "The world will never know the extreme poverty of the Confederate soldier at this time. Hundreds of men were barefoot. Every one of them was ragged, and many had nothing but what they had on, and none had eaten a square meal in weeks. In passing through the Union camps, they had a great temptation thrown their way. Many of the tents were open, and in plain sight were rations, shoes, overcoats, and blankets. Some of the men stopped, secured well-filled haversacks, and as they investigated their contents, the temptation to stop and eat was too great. They had nothing since the evening before. Others tried on shoes, others put on warm pants in place of tattered ones, and others got overcoats and blankets, articles so much needed for the coming winter." What this meant, of course, is once they drove the 6th Corps off this hill and northward, more and more Confederate soldiers were dropping out of the ranks, thus weakening an already outnumbered Confederate army. Once the Confederates reached their final line of advance north of Middletown, at stop number 8, our next stop, it is estimated that one-third of the Confederate Army was now out of their ranks and plundering the overrun Union camps. We will continue to follow the Union retreat and Confederate advance by proceeding to stop number 8. When you reach that location, pull off to the right side of the road as far as possible. You will see an historic brick structure to your left through heavy vegetation on the left side of the road. This is known as Miller's Mill, the location of the final Confederate line. You're now located at stop number 8, the historic Miller House, which is the red brick structure you see immediately to your left beyond the trees. Mr. Miller owned a mill, which was located just to your right and downhill along Meadowbrook. More importantly, from the battle perspective, the road you're about to drive on, today called Cuggle Road, at the time of the battle was a farm lane, Miller's Lane, which was lined with walls and marks the final location of the Confederate advance that day. As you drive along this lane, keep in mind that the lane was not only lined with walls, but there was much less vegetation existing in 1864, and thus the fields to your right as you drive along the lane were much more open. The Union battle line would be rallying at this point approximately 1 mile to your north, which would be to the right of the lane as you drive along it. By this time, the Confederate soldiers who reached this point were nearly exhausted, having fought a six-hour battle on top of an all-night march. Keep in mind, too, that one-third of the Confederate Army was still away from their battle lines and to the rear, plundering the Union camps, as we discussed at stop number 7. A controversy occurs here between the top two commanders in the Confederate Army. General John Brown Gordon, the mastermind behind this Confederate attack, which at this point had been overwhelmingly successful, now believed it was just a matter of reorganizing the Confederate line for one more final push to drive the Union Army off the battlefield. The top Confederate commander, General Jubal Early, however, believed the battle was over, and the Union Army would have no choice but to continue its retreat to Winchester, 15 miles north of Middletown. Early's decision will stand, however, and the Confederate Army advances no further. As we will soon learn, at stop number 9, the battle was not over, and these exhausted, disorganized Confederate soldiers would soon face, that afternoon, an overwhelming Union counterattack. You can now proceed to stop number 9. Keep in mind, when you reach Klein's Mill Road, just before stop 9, you are driving along the final location of the Union battle line where it rallied for its counterattack that afternoon. Stop number 9 is located on a small concrete bridge which spans Meadowbrook along Klein's Mill Road. You know you're approaching the bridge or nearing the bridge as you see off to your right a dark wooden fence followed by an old limestone wall which fronts a white house just off to the right of the road in which a windmill is adjacent. Just beyond the house and the wall is the bridge over Meadowbrook. Just pull off to the right side of the road in the gravel on top of the bridge. You're now located at stop number 9, where Klein's Mill Road crosses Meadowbrook. If you look downstream, you will be looking to your south. Keep in mind, it was along this road, which existed in 1864, where the defeated Union Army will take up its final line of battle as it begins to reorganize from its morning defeat. Keep in mind that General Sheridan was still located at Winchester, 15 miles north of here, and had planned to return to his army during the day on October 19th. He begins his 15-mile ride from Winchester that morning unaware a battle has even taken place. Although he does initially hear sounds of battle in the distance, he assumes it's just simply some skirmishing and makes nothing more of it. However, as his ride south continues up the Valley Pike, more ominous signs of a real battle begin to appear before him. Louder noises of battle, and then soon he meets retreating Union forces, some in panic, retreating back towards Winchester. At that point, Sheridan realizes not only has a battle taken place, but apparently his army has suffered a great disaster. As he meets more and more of his shattered army retreating towards Winchester, they begin to cheer him, and Sheridan instantly began to shout at his men, "If you love your country, don't cheer me, but return to your army." At which pace his ride began to quicken towards the battlefield. This begins what is going to go down in history, both in art and poetry, as Sheridan's ride. This 13-mile ride will bring Sheridan to his army, where the Klein's Mill Road that you're currently on meets the Valley Pike to your east or to your left. Upon his arrival, Sheridan described the first sight he had of his defeated forces. He said, "There burst upon our view the appalling spectacle of panic. I stared at my stricken army, hundreds of slightly wounded men, throngs of others unhurt but utterly demoralized, and baggage wagons by the score all pressing to the rear in hopeless confusion, telling only too plainly that a disaster had occurred at the front." At that point, Sheridan's army, stretched along this road, is in the act of reorganizing. Upon meeting his top commanders, including General Wright, they tell him the army they believed is in good enough shape at that point to conduct an orderly withdrawal back to Winchester, many Union officers believing that's the best the army could do at that point. Sheridan, however, believed the army should not retreat, but instead counterattack, hoping to not only regain his campsites, but also gain a victory out of the jaws of defeat here at Cedar Creek. At which point, Sheridan then will begin to reorganize his army for a final Union counterattack that afternoon. In order to restore his men's morale, Sheridan also believes in showing himself to his defeated forces, at which point he will ride the length of his battle line, riding along the road from your east to west, and then returning along that same line. One member of his defeated army later described the impact of Sheridan's ride along his line had upon his men. He said the men sprang to their feet and cheered only as men under such circumstances can. Hope and confidence returned at a bound. No longer did we merely hope the worst was over, that we could hold our ground until night, or at worst make a good orderly retreat to Winchester. Now we all burned to attack the enemy, to drive him back, to retrieve our honor and sleep in our old campground that night. And every man knew that Sheridan would do it. By 4 o'clock, the Union Army had reorganized itself enough to launch this attack. Holding the far right end of the Union line would be a division of Union cavalry commanded by Major General George Armstrong Custer. Custer had been a classmate and very good friend of Stephen Dodson Ramser, whom we described earlier in this tour, and now who commanded a Confederate division holding a section of Miller's Lane, the final Confederate battle line, about a mile to your south or downstream from this location. Soon these two friends, now enemies, would meet once again on the field of battle when the Union Army launched its counterattack at 4 p.m. across the fields to your south and towards the Confederate line. We will discuss the final Union counterattack and the end of the battle at stop number 10. Now proceed to stop number 10, which is located at the southernmost parking lot of the Lord Fairfax Community College campus. This parking lot is located on the opposite side of the Valley Pike from Coggle Road. Park as close as possible to the western end of that lot and near the state historical marker that reads the Battle of Cedar Creek. You're now located at stop number 10. You should be standing next to the state historical marker labeled the Battle of Cedar Creek. Face the road. Looking to your front left front, you'll notice the metal roof of the Miller House, which again is located along modern Coggle Road, then Miller's Lane. Keep in mind, as we discussed at stop number 8, that house and lane marked the final Confederate line. This line also stretched to the Valley Pike where we're standing, and also on this side, or the east side, of the pike as well. By 4 p.m., General Sheridan had reorganized his army to the point where he could launch his counterattack with the hopes of regaining a victory here at Cedar Creek. This counterattack then would sweep across the open fields before you from your right to left, striking the Confederate line along Miller's Lane. The initial Confederate resistance was quite fierce, as one Union soldier later recounted this part of the fighting. He said, "We got into the open field, the rebels pouring into our faces a deadly fire from behind the stone walls. We gain a hill in front of their line, and here we halt and pour in our fire. Of all the fires I was ever under, I think this was by far the hottest. The air boils and seethes with mini-balls and screeching shells and solid shot and deadly canister, all of which tear and plunge through our ranks. Our boys fall thick and fast." Losses were heavy, however, on both sides, and one of the casualties of this fight along Miller's Lane would be none other than General Ramseur, General Custer's West Point classmate and friend. Near or beyond the Miller House, Ramseur would be shot and fatally wounded, the bullet passing through both lungs. His staff would put Ramseur in an ambulance and attempt to take him to the rear, through Middletown and to a Confederate hospital. Meanwhile, the fight continued to seethe along Miller's Lane, and the Union battle line, being longer, was eventually able to turn the Confederate left beyond the Miller House, at which point part of the Confederate line began to retreat. Completing the Union victory and driving the Confederates off the field at that point would be Union cavalry, part of which, again, is led by General Custer, Ramseur's friend. Custer's division of cavalry swept across the open ground beyond the Confederate left and turned the Confederate retreat into a rout. Now, stricken with panic and trying to save themselves, Confederates began to move as quickly as possible off the field through Middletown and across the very fields they'd fought so hard to gain earlier that day. The retreat would take them past Belle Grove, to and beyond Cedar Creek, and in pure panic all the way through the streets of Strasburg, at which point a traffic jam literally crowded the streets of the town, and Union cavalry swept down and captured hundreds of wagons, all 24 cannons the Union Army had lost earlier that day, plus 24 Confederate cannons, so a total of 48, and over 1,000 Confederate soldiers. Amongst the captured was the mortally wounded General Ramseur. His ambulance was taken back to Belle Grove, where he received medical treatment by Union doctors inside one of the rooms at Belle Grove. Joining him that night, his friend, General Custer, would sit at his bedside, along with other Union officers who knew Ramseur, and watch his final moments pass away. Ramseur would die the next morning, October 20th. The Battle of Cedar Creek was obviously a great Union victory, which ended the 1864 Valley Campaign. Total casualties were extremely heavy on both sides. Union casualties numbered over 5,700, including 600 dead. Confederate casualties, for an army much smaller, were still rather high, nearly 3,000. Thus, the combined casualties of the two armies here at Cedar Creek were over 8,600 killed, wounded, and captured, making this the second bloodiest battle ever fought in the Shenandoah Valley. Those numbers I just rattled off to you, we sometimes look as simply statistics. However, each number represents a person, a victim of the Battle of Cedar Creek. Also are the unseen victims, the families and loved ones at home who are awaiting the fate of their soldiers on the battlefield. All of this is understood very well when one reads an account of the aftermath of this battle. A Sixth Corps soldier in the Union Army described the aftermath the night of the battle as he passed over the fields before you. He later wrote, "The dead and dying of the two armies were commingled. Many of the wounded had dragged themselves to streams in the search of the first want of a wounded man, water. Many mangled and loose horses were straggling over the field. Wagons and gun carriages and caissons are strewn in disorder. Abandoned ambulances, sometimes filled with dead and dying, were to be seen in large numbers, and loose teams dragged overturned vehicles over the hills and through the ravines. Dead and dying men were everywhere. Cries of agony from the suffering victims were heard in all directions, and the moans of the wounded animals added much to the horrors of that night. I hope you enjoyed this podcast tour of the Cedar Creek Battlefield, and that you enjoy the rest of your stay in the valley. A reminder to visit our partner visitor facilities and sites, as these nonprofit organizations strive to preserve Cedar Creek and Belgrove National Historical Park. Remember, every dollar you spend at a partner site will help preserve the battlefield.
The Battle of Cedar Creek finally ended effective Confederate military presence in the Shenandoah Valley. Many historians believe that the Union victory here helped Lincoln win re-election to his second term just weeks later. The music for this podcast is performed by Wayne Erbson from his Battlefield Ballads of the Civil War CD. For more on the battle and information about programs and tours, see the Cedar Creek and Belgrove National Historical Parks website at nps.gov/CEBE.